Hi, Denise Howell here, and you're about to join us for This Week in Law. Joshua Kroll is our guest this week. He's a researcher at UC Berkeley. Emery Roan and Mike Keyes, my co-hosts, are here as well. With Joshua, we're going to talk about some of his scholarship and work in the areas of accountability by design, the extreme vetting initiative of the Trump administration, Bitcoin economics, past, present, and future. We'll look at oral argument, which happened this week in the Carpenter case, perhaps the Supreme Court's most important privacy case of the term, and Animoji karaoke, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Matt Curtis. Episode 408, recorded December 1st, 2017. Have cat, own broom. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an incredible lineup of topics today and an incredible panel of co-hosts joining me and one incredibly wonderful guest. I'll introduce our guest first. That is Joshua Kroll. Joshua is a postdoctoral researcher at UC Berkeley School of Information. He's also a FFF, a friend of Felton, Ed Felton, of course, a Princeton researcher, computer scientist, and author of the Freedom to Tinker blog, who also advised Joshua on his PhD dissertation and co-authored a really interesting paper with him on the economics of Bitcoin mining. We're going to talk about that today, a bunch of other things. Joshua's thesis, which I mentioned, is called Accountable Algorithms, and talks about how we go forward into hopefully our not dystopic future with AI more and more making decisions for society. He's also been a systems engineer with Cloudflare, one of our sponsors here on the TWiL Network. Joshua, so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denise. So nice to be here.
Also joining me is Mike Keyes, who is a partner at Dorsey and Whitney in Seattle and one of the co-authors of their wonderful blog called The TMCA. Hi, Mike. Great to see you.
Good morning, Denise. Happy Indictment Day.
Happy Indictment Day to you as well.
And, great to be here with all of you, and I'm super excited to speak with Joshua today. This will be a lot of fun.
I know, me too. We're recording this on December 1st, if you're wondering what we're referring to. Also joining me is co-host Emery Roan, new admittee to the California Bar. Yay!
Congratulations.
I get sworn
so
in on
excited
Tuesday.
For you, Emery. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Wow. It's been a heck of a journey. And yeah, it's been, you know, I can't tell you how great it's been to have the support of the TWiL folks behind me and the Twitch chat. It's just, it's been great. And now the real work begins.
Yeah. You get sworn in next week, I understand.
I do, on Tuesday.
Very excited. Any details of that? Are you showing up at court in just a big gaggle of people, or how's that going to go down?
Oh, you know, I don't know the details enough, to be honest. Okay. It's at a hotel in San Diego. I don't know the details.
All right. Well, congratulations and enjoy the process of being sworn in.
Thanks.
And I'm sure the celebrations afterwards.
Thanks. Yeah, there definitely will be.
All right. So I thought we'd start this show off, since we're so fortunate to have Joshua Kroll with us here today, talking about some of Joshua's research and our hopefully non-dystopic AI future. So let's go there first. Joshua, I have not read your dissertation. I have read its abstract, and I've read your post from the London School of Economics site concerning your thesis, Accountable Algorithms. So I think I get the gist, and I'm excited to be able to delve into it
more deeply with you here today. But from what I can gather, the crux of your suggested approach is something called accountability by design. That is, more and more of our decisions are being made by machine learning programs and artificial intelligence. And as more and more AIs are building AIs, we need to be thinking about oversight for those processes at the computer science level. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So I guess what I mean by that is that, you know, all of these things are artifacts. They're tools that are built by people. And I think it's important to remember that and to remember that they that they're not, you know, they don't come out of nature. They don't come handed down to us in a pure way. It's sort of tempting to say that these are just systems that use data. People talk about big data or data analytics for a long time. And you might say, well, you know, we just go out there, we collect the data, and then we process it, and it tells us what to do. And that's great. But there are places all along that path where you pick up sort of the biases and the preferences of the humans who build those tools and choose how to use them. And so in order to keep systems working well or working kind of in a well-governed way, I sort of think a lot about governance and the public policy process and how these systems relate to the law. And I don't think these problems are specific to AI, although or machine learning or data science, although there is certainly an air in those environments that the data are objective, in a way that if a human programmer sits down and writes a program, it's clearly something that they've said or some choices that they've made. And so it's a little bit clearer that the agency resides with a human. But I really think what we need to do is demand evidence from these systems at a technical level that's convincing, that tells us what the systems are doing, and that they are doing the thing we think of as correct, or the thing we think of as complying with the law, and that reflects some other kind of norm that we might have, you know, a social norm or a political norm or an ethical norm. Right now, we don't have that. We have sort of everyone just using the technology, and people often using the technology we see to kind of wash their hands of that responsibility or that agency, and saying, well, you know, the data told me that I should send more police to your neighborhood, and that's why I sent more police to your neighborhood. And that's, you know, it's not that the department is biased against minorities, and that's why we sent more police to the minority neighborhood. The data just tell us that that's what we should be doing. There are even cases where it's, you know, the data tell us that you're a high risk to commit crimes, and so we think that you deserve a harsher sentence or more time in jail, or that you're not eligible for probation. That is a real thing and has happened. And there was a very interesting court case in Wisconsin about that, the state of Wisconsin versus Eric Loomis. I should mention.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask you to expand on that case a little bit more, since I don't think we've covered it on the show. We may have.
Sure. So, the case, Mr. Loomis was accused of and ultimately convicted after taking a plea bargain of being the driver in a drive-by shooting. Up until he took the plea bargain, maintained his innocence. And in the case at sentencing, after once he took the plea bargain, the court ordered a pre-sentencing investigation, which is standard. They, as part of the pre-sentencing investigation, used a commercial product known as Compass, which is a criminal people call them criminal risk assessments or recidivism risk assessments. And the idea is that it's a tool that uses some data science to predict whether someone is likely to commit another crime, and also it scores people on whether they're likely to commit another violent crime or any violent crime in the future, regardless of whether they've committed one in the past. What goes into that tool is information about someone's criminal history, some demographic information like their age and gender, and their answers to a questionnaire that considers a number of what the tool's authors call criminogenic factors. So these are things like whether you have been in jail before, whether you've had family in jail, how much time you've been in jail, whether you have substance abuse problems, whether you have financial problems, your sort of risk tolerance with respect to gambling and other things. And so based on these factors and the criminal history, it produces a risk score, which is supposed to encapsulate and does encapsulate the probability that you will be arrested again in the next 2 years. Based on his high-risk score, the judge at sentencing said that the sentence was explicitly said that the sentence was based on Mr. Loomis's high score and also the high projected needs that he had. The risk assessment doesn't just give a single number; it gives a sort of a set of reasons for why it came to that conclusion, which it calls a needs assessment, which is basically a measure of, you know, how likely are you to have a substance abuse problem? How likely are you to sort of fall in with criminal elements? How likely are you to have some kind of financial problem that would lead you toward criminal activity? And so it provides sort of not a ranking, but an intensity score for each of these factors. And the judge said, you know, based on the fact that the risk is high and the projected needs are high, that he should get a very harsh sentence that was within the guidelines, but on the high end for the crimes which he had pled guilty to. And he appealed based on the theory that the use of his gender in the risk assessment was an impermissible use of a prohibited factor in sentencing and that violated his due process rights. The case went ultimately up to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, which ruled that judges can continue to use the tools, although it also ruled in a way that I find troubling, which is that judges can use the tools so long as the tools are not the determinative factor in the sentence. Which is sort of an argument that the judge's sentence should be the same with the tool and without the tool, which implies that the tool should be meaningless.
Right.
But we know that the tool can pull people's opinion in a certain way, and often in ways that are biased in problematic ways. There's a great article by the journalistic group ProPublica about the use of this same product Compass in Broward County, Florida, where they found that the rate at which Black people in Broward County, Florida are ranked as high risk by the tool and ultimately not rearrested. So to say they're false positives, they are falsely ranked as high risk when they're not actually high risk. That rate for Black people is twice as high in Broward County, Florida, as it is for white people.
I have a question, Joshua.
I
understand that, you know, a lot of these algorithms are designed to approximate the decision-making process that, for example, in this example, that the judges would be making when they're giving the sentence. But how easy is it sort of after the fact to go back and discern a bias from algorithmic-based decisions as opposed to just your judge that's not using these tools but may himself be biased anyways? Like, is it better for – I don't know if I'm nailing on the question exactly, but it feels like at least with algorithmic tools like this that spit out, you know, numbers at the end of the day that, you know, that explain at least why the tool came to the conclusion that it did, that at least oversight organizations can go back in and quantify and say, oh, look, here clearly is a bias evidence in the data. Is that an easier analysis to make with these algorithmic tools as opposed to against a non-algorithmic based decision?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly encapsulates something that is a key idea, not just in my dissertation, but also in a law review article that I wrote based on my dissertation with an enormous number of people. It's, as far as I know, the only law review article in existence with seven authors. Anyway, it's in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review, and it has the same title, Accountable Algorithms, which I think I wouldn't have done if I'd known it would break Google Scholar. But anyway, so one of the arguments we make is that because you can because an automated decision making system, whether it's a machine learning system or a system that's written by a human, is at base a machine, something that's predictable and understandable, we should hold it to a higher standard, right? You cannot go to a judge and determine why they made a decision sort of mechanistically. You can't break that decision down in terms of their particular thought process or the logic that was applied. You can ask them and they can explain it to you, but there's nothing in that justification that comes later that actually caused the decision. It's just sort of an explanation of the decision or a rationalization of the decision. But in a machine, you can say this decision happened because this logic triggered. And then we can ask the question, is that logic the right logic? Do we want that logic to be there? Or do we want different logic there? And so this kind of gets into the question that Denise asked earlier about accountability. One of the big, I think, distinctions that I've made in my own work is the distinction between thinking about these issues in an ex ante way. So thinking about what is the right answer, and because once you have a specification of the right answer, you know, computer scientists, we can go off into our dark rooms and we can build it and we can make sure that it satisfies that goal and doesn't have that many bugs, or if you have the resources, you can build things in a way that you can guarantee that they don't have any bugs. And the other alternative is to think of it in an ex post way. And often in law or policymaking, this change from ex ante to ex post gives you a lot of power, because when you're thinking about a problem purely ex ante, you actually have to specify a full accounting of what you want to happen. You have to say, you know, this is what it means to discriminate. This is what it means to have fair use in a copyright situation. This is illegal hate speech. This is not illegal hate speech. Obviously, many of those analyses are going to be contextual. They're going to be quite subtle. And it would be really hard to draw a bright line ahead of time. And so what we do is the bright line we draw ahead of time is we say, we don't know how to specify this, but we can put this person in charge of telling us after the fact. This person might be a judge. It might be a legislative committee. It might be the internal affairs team in a police department or at a company. It might be some kind of oversight board that's set up for a specific purpose. But in all of those cases, the role of that entity is to consider using a process that everyone can buy into what makes something fair. And it's that that process that I think really kind of allows you to build the necessary ambiguity into policymaking so that people can agree on something and move forward and not fight forever about the specifics of what constitutes discrimination.
That's a really interesting point about the role of ambiguity in allowing policy to move forward. I hadn't heard it that put that way before, but that's very eloquent.
Yeah. I have an observation and a question, Joshua. The observation is, I think it's so telling that our IRC is going, of course, straight to pre-crime in hearing you describe this case, but it's really post-crime we're talking about here. We're talking about something that is being used not to determine guilt, but to determine sentencing, and probably for that reason has a lower standard of what we're willing to let it do. And as you said, the state Supreme Court decided it could still be used. I suspect that we'd be having a very different conversation if it had been somehow factored into finding guilt in this case. So I think it's fascinating to watch. You know, certainly the justice system, how long you spend in jail, and the severity of your sentence, where you do your time, how you do your time, is an incredibly important part of our justice system, and that we should be vigilant in tools that are being used for that part of the process as well. And then my question for you, based on your research and writing, is taking that example, that compass system that was used, how would you apply accountability by design to make that? You argue that transparency is not what we're after, more accountability. How would you apply those principles to that particular fact set?
Can I piggyback on that question as well, and maybe add an addendum to that question? Because I'm interested in the way that these are private companies, or private companies make this product Compass. How are we? Is there research being done into these private companies themselves? Is there any conflict of interest? Or how do we know that there's no conflict of interest? Rather, that a situation couldn't come up where a private prison company makes a product that is a automated sentencing tool that is then used to funnel people into the prisons. I mean, is that how do we build accountability at that level as well, I guess?
So the actually, to the point of whether it's pre-crime or not, I think it's interesting to think about where the feedback loops are in this system. And the fact that you spend more time in jail, or you spend time in jail pre-trial even, that you don't get bail, because that's what the system was developed to do. It was developed to determine whether you are whether you should be subject to bail before trial, and also whether you are a candidate for alternative sanctions like parole, non-custodial sanctions after conviction. And we know from studies of the criminal populations in this country that spending more time in prison gives you a higher probability of committing future crime or being arrested again. And that is, I think, important to remember when we think about whether mistakes in these systems are convicting people wrongfully, or whether they are predicting future crime in some way. And to the question of how would you apply accountability here, I think one of the things I've written about a lot is how transparency is the wrong answer. And that, I think, is a product of some specific legal scholarship that I was responding to, where people didn't necessarily say that transparency was a complete answer on its own, but did sort of indicate that someone should be able to look under the hood and figure out how these systems work. And being able to do that is actually something that people wanted to do in order to figure out. And the idea was that if you just have all the details, right, it's a machine. If you know all the details of how it works, you can figure out whether that working is problematic and change it. And I think what I'm advocating is not so different from that, but I also think that you have to be a little bit careful about what you disclose, because if you disclose everything about how something works, it becomes very gameable. And so if we said, you know, we're a little bit uncomfortable with the way that the no-fly list works, and we say this is what gets you on the no-fly list and what doesn't get you on the no-fly list, then people will start to adjust their behavior, and people who might otherwise have landed on, on the wrong side of the TSA or of Immigration and Customs Enforcement will suddenly not be doing that anymore. And you might say, well, that diminishes the effectiveness of those entities. But also in the Compass case, the model is fairly simple. There are lots of machine learning tools which are really hard to interpret. And Compass seems to be built on technologies that people think are much easier to interpret. But it's still problematic to understand because it's proprietary, because it has, when law enforcement agencies or departments of corrections buy this tool, they sign contracts which contain confidentiality clauses that say that they can't reveal how the tool works. They're not going to get information about how the tool works. And if they do figure out things about how the tool works, they can't disclose them any further. And those confidentiality obligations protect the integrity of the tool is the argument that the vendor would make. However, there is an interesting problem for sort of the rights of the accused in confronting evidence against them, especially if the risk assessment is used in sort of in a setting where it's sort of bears more on whether someone is convicted as opposed to just their sentencing. How would you apply accountability in this case? I think the answer is that you have to be able to pull out the relevant information about how this system is working. That includes knowing things about, for example, the racial bias or the gender bias that this system has. Not to say that bias is not a bad word in machine learning. Bias is how we tell the difference between one class of thing and another class of thing, and that turns out to be really important to the functioning of the system. But what we don't want is discriminatory bias or bias against a protected, legally protected group or a group which has been historically disadvantaged for some reason. And so it's that that kind of bias that becomes problematic, and being aware of that kind of bias, when you interpret the results of the system and actually trying to measure how the system works in context, right? So we can do something like what the ProPublica folks did and measure whether the system was correct for a set of offenders. And we can say, you know, what fraction of the time did it rate offenders as high risk and they actually were rearrested or did appear to commit additional crimes. We can go out and look as well at, how did the system work in concert with humans, right? So the system is designed to be used by judges or by other professionals in the criminal justice system, and we can ask, you know, what they do, how it impacts their decision. We can do experiments where we change maybe the formatting of the reports or the way the information is presented or how much explanation it's presented with or whether it's presented with the disclaimers that the Wisconsin Supreme Court said it has to be presented with, whether that impacts people's opinions about it, whether that impacts people's actual use of it, the decisions they make based on it. I think all of that is important, and all of that needs to be, all that information needs to be collected. It needs to be reviewable by the public, because how we sentence criminals is a policy decision that should go through kind of a review process that's available to the public either directly or through some legislative or other rulemaking body. And so it shouldn't be the case that these decisions are just made kind of de facto by the way that procurement is done or by the fact that a particular tool was purchased and put in place for a particular situation.
So I know that you've pushed back against – sorry. I was just saying that I know that you stress the importance of transparency but say that, you know, completely transparent is not necessarily the answer. I was just – curious what your take is on the people that say that this code should be open source as a matter of policy. Do you support that or find any problems specifically with like sentencing algorithms, obviously, and certain circumstances like in the ones that you described, transparency wouldn't be permitted or would break the process. But for this type of algorithmic tool, would open source be at least a step in the right direction, or do you think that it should be required or should not be?
I think open source is a step in the right direction. I think there are cases where it probably should be required. I also think that people tend to vest it with more power than it actually has. Mm-hmm. And the example I'll give for that is the city of New York just had a blockbuster hearing on a proposed city council law that says that all systems that are used by city agencies must be open sourced. And that includes models such as Compass, but also models that they use to, for example, figure out how to deploy, road crews, figure out where the potholes are likely to be. I think that kind of openness is good and useful and supports all sorts of open government values that that are very important. I also think that in many cases, that kind of disclosure doesn't tell you everything you want to know. So you mm-hmm. might, for example, want to know some kind of property that isn't a property so much of the technology, but of the technology as it's applied or the tool as it's used by people. So the tool is in many cases a decision support tool, right? It's not saying, it's not actually sending the trucks out to fix the potholes. It's not actually putting a person in prison. It's a tool. It's presented to a human decision maker, and the human decision maker relies on the tool to help them make a decision that they were going to make anyway. And I think it's important to focus on how the tool kind of composed with the human is operating, and to ask, if that process is some kind of important process. It's a criminal process. It controls the liberty of a person. It's even if it's a procurement process, it controls money that the some government entity is spending. We may want some kind of audit trail, some kind of information about how that process is operating that needs to be generated along the way so that it can be reviewed later by a competent oversight authority, and that authority actually has the information necessary for them to do their job. And that's sort of what I mean in my work by accountability, that you've thought about the evidence that's necessary to do that. And that's not just going to be in the context of artificial intelligence or machine learning. You could think of voting systems as working this way, right? Voting systems create evidence of what they are doing the whole way along so that when you have a challenged election, you can say, well, we can go back and we can look at the voter rolls and we can make sure only eligible people were registered to vote. And we can look at the voter sign-in books and we can say only people who were registered actually signed in and voted. And these other people came to the polls and they didn't, they weren't in the voter roll, but for some reason we thought they might be eligible to vote. So we collected their preferences on a provisional ballot, and that provisional ballot is tied to them in a way that an oversight entity can, after the election, review whether or not it should be included in the count. And then when we count, we start with a ballot box, and at the beginning of the day, that ballot box is opened, it's turned upside down, someone reaches their hand into it and bangs it around to demonstrate that there are no secret compartments or hidden bundles of ballots inside. The ballot box is inspected by observers, ideally from opposing political parties. It is then sealed. People put their ballots into it at the end of the day, and then that box is unsealed only in the presence of observers from opposing parties who we think are not going to collude with each other to get something done. So I think there, and in a lot of cases, open source gets you some of the way to where you want to go. It tells you how something is working, but it doesn't tell you that kind of those kind of process properties that you want out of a system, or kind of how it's influencing humans. And that's also important when you're going to capture evidence about how a system is working, to understand how it impacts the humans that are supposed to be using it.
Joshua, you wrote your dissertation a few years back, and I'm wondering if you were writing it today, would you include a section on applying accountability by design to AI that is built to help others build their own AI? We have a piece in our rundown for this week by Cade Metz in the San Francisco Chronicle called How AI is Working to Build a Better AI. And it loosely discusses how various huge tech companies are cornering the market for AI experts, partially for their own needs, but partially because they foresee this huge market of other businesses and developers wanting to use AI but not having the talent to build it out themselves. So you would go to someone like a Google or a Microsoft and use their cloud computing AI service to then build your own AI. With that level of middleman, does accountability become more complicated or impossible?
I don't think it becomes more complicated. I think that in a lot of cases, having a cloud provider can be really helpful, because if you imagine that there's some sort of audit trail requirement that you want to exist, that a centralized provider is more well-resourced to make that happen, to implement the technology that's necessary to support it, and to deal with, staying on the cutting edge, mm-hmm. right? Because let's say a car manufacturer does not have the resources in their IT department or even their data science unit to take that on. In the same way that they don't have the resources to maybe do the fancy machine learning that they want to do to analyze the data that they have. The danger that I see in that kind of scenario is that there's a sort of an over-reductionist tendency to say that data are just data, and so what we should do is we should look at the data and we should pick what we're optimizing about the data, and then we should sort of send it off to the data scientists, and the data scientists will turn the crank and they will optimize everything and they will, make it as tight as possible. And then they come back with a set of decisions or a set of recommendations, and those get implemented. But there isn't really, at some point you've lost kind of details about what the data mean or what stands behind the data. And that can wander you into a number of problems where when you build these models and you optimize them, you've chosen a particular task that the model is trying to predict. So you've chosen, we're going to predict whether someone is likely to flee if you let them go on bail pre-trial and for how much bail. Versus, they're a flight risk and they should be detained prior to trial. That is a particular task. If you take that model and repurpose it for some different task, like what should this person's sentence be, it's likely not to work, or some of the assumptions of the model are likely to have become wrong. And as a result of that, the model will not work as well on that other task. And so I worry that when you have these generic machine learning systems, Google has this, I think they call it their decisions API or something like that. You upload some data, they crank on it, they give you back the answer, and it comes down with this air of authority that says this is the answer, even though it doesn't maybe relate to the original problem that you were asking, or you don't know how it relates to the original problem you were asking. And so I think you kind of are losing control of the process, and it becomes less a sort of a situation where humans are sitting down and building tools that are built to a purpose and advance well-defined goals, and more just a situation where you're pushing numbers around on a page that don't necessarily relate to anything. There are other options, right? You could imagine having a suite of machine learning tools available and usable, and then professional services that sit on top of that from a cloud provider, where they come in and they try to understand the problem and the task and how those tools can be applied. And I think that's a reasonably common framework in a lot of cloud environments where you have, you know, like a solutions engineer or someone who works to integrate a product into your company's specific set of needs. And that isn't necessarily something that that is always happening in the case of these kind of AI generated AIs or
yeah. I'm sitting here envisioning, and I'm sure it's going to happen, the AI generated AI that assesses whether your AI generated AI is sufficiently accountable. And we'll go on from there.
But it does feel like that's one of the potential solutions, right? I mean, if we're worried about algorithmic bias, can we make an algorithm that can help us identify bias and figure out whether these other ones are accountable?
Yeah, so I guess what I would say to that is there are many ways to measure bias, and we've gotten a lot better in the last couple of years at figuring out how to define it or how to measure it. And people are starting to wake up to the idea that you have to measure it. And there are even tools that allow you to define kind of specific kinds of fairness criteria. So maybe a fairness criterion you want is proportional representation. You want the number of college students you admit to reflect the ratio of people in the general population or the applicant pool by gender, by racial grouping, by some other protected status, your favorite, by income, let's say. You want that kind of diversity. And that's a bit of a strong criterion. Maybe you want a different criterion, which is like equality of opportunity, that says that qualified members of a protected group have an equal chance of getting a loan, say, as qualified members of the majority. You might want a fairness property, as was the case in the Compass scoring system, that the system is well calibrated, meaning that the score you get corresponds nicely to the probability that you will be arrested again in 2 years. And that property is true of the Compass system. It's also true of the Compass system for both black people and white people. And it's also mathematically incompatible with the property that ProPublica was looking for, which is that the false positive rates and the false negative rates are equalized for those two groups. So it is impossible because more black people are arrested in the jurisdiction that they were looking at in Broward County, Florida, the chance of being arrested as a black person is more than twice as high than as a white person in that jurisdiction. Because of that, it's mathematically impossible to have both the fact that the score corresponds to your risk of arrest and that the false positive rate, the chance that you are rated as a high risk when in fact you will not commit another crime within 2 years. Those cannot both be equalized across races. It's mathematically impossible.
Okay, well, I think that's actually a good segue to take this from the realm of research and scholarship to the realm of legislation, regulation, and policy, where these principles become law and have real impact. Before we move into that, I want to talk about federal extreme vetting and a letter that was put together by 56 civil rights, civil liberties, government accountability, human rights, immigrant rights, and privacy organizations and scholars, including Joshua Kroll, who's with us here today, discussing the viability of the federal government's proposed extreme vetting immigration program. Before we get to that, we should put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases into the show in case you are someone who would like to seek to obtain professional credit in your field. whether you're a lawyer or in some other field, certain oversight bodies like to have some sort of concrete way of demonstrating that you watched or listened to the show. So we put some random phrases into each episode that you should write down if you are interested in seeking credit in your jurisdiction. Our first one is designing accountability. And we'll put another one in before the end of the show for your convenience. But let's talk about this letter that you signed on to, Josh, and why it is problematic that the federal government hopes to develop processes that will look at various predictive aspects of someone's life to try and determine if they are more likely to commit a crime or a terrorist act. Here we're moving from the COMPASS system, which dealt with sentencing, to something that is much more predictive of in the realm of pre-crime and trying to take actions based on those kinds of factors. What does the letter say, and in what way does it specify that this isn't a good idea?
Sure. So there are two letters. I think the one you showed was from a number of, as you said, a bunch of civil society organizations that work on relevant issues. There was mm-hmm. a second letter. The one that I signed was a shorter expert letter that's signed by 54, I think, computer scientists and data science experts and artificial intelligence machine learning researchers who oppose just purely on its technical merits, that the system as proposed is unlikely to work for the goals that it is meant to achieve. And so I don't want to put aside, because I think they're important, these human rights, civil rights issues that are likely to come up in the course of building such a tool, that it's likely to be used for discriminatory purposes, that it's likely to treat people in already marginalized communities in a more aggressive way than they're already treated by these agencies. If you look at the procurement documents, they include phrases which were taken from the first Trump administration Muslim ban order from the first week of the Trump administration. And those phrases were ultimately sort of challenged in court and have been held in multiple courts to be violative of constitutional rights. But also those phrases were removed from subsequent drafts of the order and so ultimately walked back by the White House itself. Mm-hmm. I think that there are sort of two reasons that we might expect the tool to not work on just purely technical merits. One is simply the fact that context is important. So the tool is mostly geared toward doing social media monitoring. And you could imagine some more responsible ways to do this where you, you're interested in people who have, say, looked at or interacted with more likely or even reposted known content of known terrorist organizations. So, right, ISIS is very good at using the internet for recruitment. And if we're concerned that someone trying to enter the United States has been recruited by ISIS and we want to look at their social media to figure this out, maybe we should look at whether they've had contact with accounts that are known to be controlled by ISIS, whether they've posted content that's known to have been produced by ISIS or ISIS affiliated accounts, and maybe we want to treat that as kind of like a normal investigative process in which we say, these things, they work in networks of cells, and we can connect this person's activity to activity that we know is bad. That's a lot more responsible, I think, than saying that, we're going to try to teach a computer to understand what people have written in their social media posts, and we're also going to teach it to use that understanding to figure out whether that content might be problematic, and we're basically going to use that as a replacement for having a bunch of ICE officers who just read everyone's social media, all of everyone's social media when they come into the country. That's clearly too many people to hire, so we're going to have a computer do it. That seems problematic to me, because the technology for understanding the text is still very nascent, and also even if it were really good, even if we were to stipulate for the purpose of argument that it were perfect, that the machine really could understand the text at the level that a human agent would, there's a context issue, right? When you write something on social media, you're responding to another person, you're responding to things that happened in your life, you're responding to the nature of the conversation. Like if you send a tweet, you're often responding to the way people are talking about things on Twitter. And so you might make a joke which is of the moment and of that conversation, but out of context or looked at 6 months later, a year later, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, or may even sound like something kind of ominous. And it's hard to explain the joke. Anyone who's come out of a conversation to explain a joke that was made in the conversation understands how challenging this is. And so you end up in this situation that I think of, or I should really credit this analogy to my wife who came up with it. I think of as the Salem witch trial situation, where you don't know how to build technology that will tell you whether someone is a witch, but you do know that you can look for people who have cats and own brooms. So because of that, you end up in a situation where you can't, right? There's no, or there isn't very much labeled data that says this person is a terrorist or this person is an ISIS fighter, because there just aren't that many of them compared to the number of people entering the United States. There are many millions of people entering the United States every year. And, the other reason that the system isn't going to work on its technical merits is just a purely mathematical reason, which is in any system, it's not perfect. It has some errors, and of those errors, some of them are going to be false positives. I marked you as risky or likely to be a terrorist when you weren't, and some of them are going to be false negatives. You actually are a terrorist, but I didn't detect you, and I said it's okay to let you into the country, and so you entered the country and something bad happens. So clearly, ICE is in the for this system wants the false negative rate to be really, really low. They want to catch all the terrorists, or they want mm-hmm. the probability that they miss a terrorist to be really small. Unfortunately, in any system, there's a trade-off between false positive and false negative rates. And so by driving that false negative rate to be really small, you of necessity drive up the false positive rate. You're going to make more false positive errors. And so what that means is the system, if it's working well, is going to generate a lot of flags that put people in contact with law enforcement when they don't need to be. And that's bad for those people. That's also bad for the mission of ICE itself, because they're charged with doing the investigative work to keep us safe and to actually keep the bad people out of the country. And if instead of doing that work, they are processing all of these people who have been flagged erroneously, they will be wasting their time and they will lose faith in the effectiveness of the system. Something that I think underscores this is in the procurement documents for this system, instead of saying, here's how you should evaluate the quality of the referrals you make to Homeland Security investigations, it just says the system must make a minimum of 10,000 referrals to Homeland Security investigations in a year. This is an increase from the number of referrals that are generated by the current program. The current processes that ICE has generate something like 8,600 referrals to Homeland Security investigations. So this is like a more than 10% increase in the number of referrals that they're getting, but there doesn't seem to be any kind of, or at least there isn't any public visible that I'm aware of, kind of stepping up of the staffing or the ability to take on that work. And there may be. The president has commented that he wants to step up the extreme vetting initiative, and you could imagine that he's quite happy to staff it. But that probably requires more funding for the Department of Homeland Security, and I wouldn't want to be in charge of getting that through Congress, but someone right. clearly is.
And it also requires, I mean, it sounds like the incentive you just described is, you know, provide us with red flags and without the parameters of really what's going to constitute a valid one. It's more about quantity than quality.
Right, exactly. That's a great way to say it, that it's, you're going for quantity of leads and you don't have a way of representing quality. And what that means is that quite likely the leads you get will be based on easy, what we would call proxies. So things that are easy to measure that that correlate but don't stand in for the particular thing that you want to measure, because we can't measure whether someone is a terrorist or not. There's no, you know, until someone commits a terrorist act, there's no kind of way to do that, right? Because that's what defines a terrorist, as someone who did a terrorist thing. And so until that happens, we can't predict that someone is a terrorist, because we can't define them as a terrorist. And so then what we'll end up doing is picking up things we can measure, like this person came from a predominantly Muslim country. This person is a Muslim. This person, an even easier proxy, this person's skin color is different from mine. This person's cultural practices are different, and maybe they are Sikh and they wear a turban. That marks them out as different, and then they get treated differently. And this person speaks a different language on social media. Helped run something in the summer called the Workshop on Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency in Machine Learning. One of the really interesting papers we had there was about how even dialects of English get misidentified by standard language identification tools that are used in natural language processing. So they showed some examples where tweets from that use linguists would call African American vernacular, or sometimes African American vernacular English, these tweets will get marked as, you know, Danish or Dutch or something else entirely by the tool, because the tool doesn't know how to deal with this dialect, and so it just makes its best guess, and its best guess is wrong, and leads to, you know, it sort of starts the a cascade of failures, and those failures or those errors can propagate through the system to the point that maybe it causes people to be flagged inappropriately, and so in the case of this ICE system, you might hope that, again, that people sort of go, there's a lot of latitude in the procurement documents to go about things in a responsible way and to generate kind of the right, selection criteria, or to support the investigative work of Homeland Security investigations, or even of ICE officers who are doing, you know, primary screening, secondary screening. There are ways you could support these people in the jobs they're doing. But that's not really what the procurement says. And what the procurement says is that we're going to figure out, based on social media, whether someone is likely to commit a crime, which is very pre-crime.
Yes. Mike, any questions for Joshua before we move on?
Man, this is really fascinating stuff, Joshua. I did have a question going back to the Loomis case for a moment. So that was a case that emanated from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as I understand it. And I believe the Supreme Court denied review of that case. Is that right? The United States Supreme Court?
Yeah. And if you're looking for something to read about that, the Supreme Court did deny cert in the Loomis case. And they took the interesting step before denying cert of asking the Justice Department to write an opinion on whether cert should be granted. And that opinion is very interesting, but it basically makes the argument that this isn't the right case to litigate in this area, and also because there's no circuit split yet, there isn't a need for review, or even a split among state Supreme Courts. The other case in this area comes out of the Indiana Supreme Court, and it didn't consider due process. There are things about the Loomis case that make it suboptimal, I think, for reviewing this subject area. But at the same time, it's not a case that at some point we're going to have to reckon with the due process implications of using software to make decisions about the liberty of citizens in this country, or even non-citizens in this country, even visitors, just going to the ICE example.
Sure. I want to move on to Bitcoin. It's been such a huge week for Bitcoin. But just to close out this topic, I wanted to comment. I love your wife's analogy, the cats, brooms, and witches one. And I wanted to kick it to Emery to see if you have any final thoughts before we move on here, Emery.
No, I just want to echo Mike. You know, this is a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Joshua, for coming on the show.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So another area of Josh's expertise has to do with Bitcoin, as we mentioned. And he is the co-author, along with Edward Felton and Ian Davey, of a piece from 2013 called The Economics of Bitcoin Mining, or Bitcoin in the Presence of Adversaries. And so I thought it would be fun, Joshua, to go back to 2013 and 2014 when people were trying to figure out what was going on with Bitcoin, and looking at your piece, trying to make some predictions as to what would happen in the future. One of the things that you thought would happen is that some sort of compensation system would have to be established for people to keep mining Bitcoin, because you didn't think the incentives were lined up for that to continue to happen as it was at that time. And you also thought that some sort of central governance was necessary, was going to have to come into play, or the system would collapse. Well, here we are in 2017. Bitcoin has topped $10,000 per Bitcoin this week. In fact, it's trading at that. Last time I checked this morning as we were doing the show, $10,545.99. Clearly the system is rolling along. I'm wondering, sort of, you know, gazing back and then into the future again, what you have to say about the thoughts that you had in 2013 and how things have panned out and how you think they will continue to pan out.
I guess what I would say first is that I should have bought Bitcoins as part of doing this project in 2013.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
I didn't. What I really should have done was I should have bought them in 2012 when a colleague of mine who is one of the sort of most libertarian people I've ever interacted with. He's sitting at his desk, and I walked into the lab where I was in grad school, and he said, "Hey, by the way, have you heard of this thing, Bitcoin? It seems really cool." And at that time, I think they were like 30 cents.
2012 was the first big blow up. I mean, that was
I think it was
we reached $1,000 at the end of 2012. So yeah,
yeah, it might have even been earlier than that. I don't know. It was very early, but anyway, in the paper that Denise was talking about, what we basically do is we apply some fairly simplistic game theory to try to understand how people how human actors in the Bitcoin system, how their decisions are mediated by the technology that operates the system. And at the time we wrote that paper, people were saying things, and you still hear people say things like, you know, you have to trust the crypto, or because the rules are enforced mathematically or they're enforced by the cryptography, they can't possibly change. And that's not really what the purpose of the cryptography in Bitcoin is. The purpose is to tell you that someone is lying or making something up or cheating, and then it's up to you as a person to figure out what to do about that. And we write behaviors into software for what they should do about that. And those behaviors are decisions that are made by people. And so even though, you know, I can download the software that the Bitcoin core developers write and run it on my computer, I could just as well, because it's an open source project, take their software, modify it to suit my own ends, and then run that software instead that behaves in a slightly different way. This comes into governance because what that means is the core developers are sort of a de facto governance mechanism, because most people in the community will just download the software that they produce and run it. And they also, if they want to make changes, have to go around in the community and get buy-in, because the way the rules are set in Bitcoin is that the mining process, which is what protects the integrity of the... So just to back up, the 10,000 view of how Bitcoin works is that we all want to make transactions. So what we agree to do is we have a ledger, and we start with some amount of money each. And then if I want to pay Denise 10 quatlus out of the ledger, just steal a currency from Star Trek, hopefully that's fair use. I don't know. Mike can tell us.
Every Star Trek reference is welcome on this show.
Yeah.
Anyway, so suppose I want to pay Denise 10 quatlus out of the ledger. So what we do is we write a new transaction in the ledger. Josh pays Denise 10 quatlus. And assuming we all agree that that transaction is supposed to be in the ledger, then everyone can agree that Denise has 10 more quatlus than she had before the transaction, and I have 10 fewer. So that's how Bitcoin works. And the question is, how do we agree whether that transaction should be in the ledger? And the answer is, that's where the cryptography comes in. So I am represented in the ledger not by my name, but by an address. The address is mathematically tied to a cryptographic key that I control. And that key is what allows me to sign over the Bitcoins from me to Denise or whoever I'm trying to pay. And the key security property is that only the person who knows that cryptographic key can do that signing over. And as a result, it's necessary that, like, that's a rule that if you see a transaction and it isn't signed by the appropriate key or the key of the sending party, then you should ignore it. You should treat it as invalid. Now, clearly, if everyone agreed that an invalid transaction should be in the ledger, then that invalid transaction would be included in the ledger, and everyone would buy into that, and believe that it is a valid transaction. And so the rules can change. The rules are just how we recognize what we see. And what changes the rules is that the ledger is updated kind of one page at a time in what the Bitcoin community calls blocks. So transactions are aggregated into blocks, and then whole blocks are inserted into the ledger at once. The way the blocks are inserted is someone gets chosen to be the person who puts the next block in, and a block is considered valid if all the transactions in it are valid, and then everyone tries to basically put more blocks into the chain. And so each block contains a reference to the block before it, and that's why it's a chain, because the most recent block references the block before it, represents the block before that, all the way back to the very first block that is sort of baked into the software. And that's what makes it a block chain. The way that person is chosen is they're chosen by attempting to solve a computational puzzle that basically simulates a lottery. So it doesn't matter who puts the block in. in as much as it matters that that we can trust them to do the right thing. And so the what we do is we make a rule that says, okay, the person who gets to put the block in is the person who solves a useless computational puzzle, and they have to do some work with computers to solve that puzzle. And then once they have a solution, then that block is deemed valid and can be put into the chain. And the puzzle has the property that it's very hard to find the solution, but very easy to determine that a solution that I offer you is a solution if I offer it to you. It's very fast to do that. And so if I want to find the solution for the next block, I have to do a lot of computational work. But once I find it and show it to you, you can verify in, you know, fractions of a second that it is a correct solution. That I'm therefore allowed to put the block in. And then in order to incentivize me to do this work, I'm also allowed to include in the block a special magic transaction that pays some reward to anyone I choose, but presumably it's me. And so when I put that block in, I get some new money that didn't exist before. It's not paid from anyone. It just comes from it's just the reward for having found that solution. And it's that reward, the value of that reward, that protects the integrity of the system. So in order to change the rules, it has to be half of the computational power that goes towards solving these puzzles in the aggregate that agrees to the rule change. And so what we said in this paper is what that means from a governance perspective is that the governance of Bitcoin is sort of like an open source project. So there is a maintainers who run it, whose job it is to get buy-in from people. They can't just do whatever they want. And once they have enough buy-in, they can make the changes they want to make, and they make those changes, and then those changes become sort of the new law of the land. That process is a community process, not so much a centralized governance mechanism, but kind of a community governance mechanism, where we do see that in Bitcoin. And I think out of this work, we've seen like exactly what we predicted has come to pass, which is that the community has come together to discuss and debate changes to the rules when people have felt they would be useful, and when people have disagreed or not been able to come to agreement, instead of making the changes, you have what we call, and what studies of open source software call, fork discipline, where some portion of the community can leave and decide that they don't want to participate in that community anymore. But because it's open source, they can pick up what's been done already and then put it down in the new community with the changes that they want, leave the sort of the old maintainers, the old governance system behind. And there have been a couple of splits of the chains. And just like the software can fork, the history of Bitcoin can also fork. So each block refers to its parent, but each parent block can have as many children as you attach to it. Ideally, only one of those children is valid. Ideally, only one of those is the right path forward into the future. But it can be the case that maybe more than one is a valid path into the future, and different people consider those paths into the future valid or not valid. And so you end up with Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, or you end up with a bunch of other things which share some common history, but at some point they decide the rules should change. And then after that, the rules are different in the different chains. And there's a lot of interesting kind of stuff about how effort can be combined across different chains. We thought in the paper, as Denise alluded to, that the thing that would cause a fork in the future would be a debate about whether the mining reward needed to be increased. And it ended up being about whether the size of blocks needed to be increased. Arguably that's the same, or at least the community falls out along very similar lines in those two arguments. So And the reason that we thought the mining reward needed to be increased is because if you think about it, and this is a very simple piece of game theory, if you think about it, the total amount of effort spent on the mining process, on solving these useless computational puzzles, must be at equilibrium exactly equal to the mining reward. So every 10 minutes, there's supposed to be a new Bitcoin block, and that block right now pays 25 Bitcoin, so it pays a little more than $25,000 at the price that Denise quoted. So what that means is there is $25,000 free in the community for effort. And clearly, if more than $25,000 per 10 minutes is being spent on mining, and that's a lot of money, by the way. I can do some math here, but let's see. 10, 5. As long as I have a calculator out, I may as well do it right. Times 25. I did the math wrong. It's $250,000 times 144 blocks per day is $37 million a day of effort. And so that effort is the electricity that's used, and it's also the capital depreciation for the mining equipment. Between $37 and $38 million a day available for that at the current price. And clearly, if more than that is being spent, then someone is losing money. And if less than that is being spent, then there's an arbitrage and people should be entering the market. So that is the price of maintaining the integrity of this system. And if you wanted to rewrite the history, you would have to outwork half of that effort. So you would have to invest enough to have more than half of 38 is 19. So more than $19 million of capital depreciation a day in your hardware, which is a lot of hardware because the hardware does not explode at midnight, right? You still have the hardware tomorrow. And electricity is not costing you $37 million a day, or if it is, yeah, you're probably like the country of Britain. Anyway, that's a long answer to a short question.
Yes. No, I have another short question that maybe will prompt a shorter answer. And that is that we have a piece in the rundown wherein economist Joseph Stiglitz is saying that Bitcoin, and I assume he means other cryptocurrencies as well, ought to be outlawed. And he also posits that the government is completely in control of that situation. He says, if the government says the reason Bitcoin is being used is circumvention, they could close it down at any moment and then it collapses. Do you think there's a big danger? Well, first of all, do you think computationally the way these currencies are set up, is he right?
I think there are ways in which he's right and ways in which he's not right. It's a very academic answer for you. It's more complicated and more research is needed.
It depends is the law school answer.
Exactly. It's a shorter way of saying it. So I think the way in which he's right is that what we've seen about Bitcoin is that it is still a niche market even as it becomes more and more mainstream. As a result, it depends on a very small number of intermediaries who connect it to the traditional financial system. And it's a lot smaller than the traditional financial system if you look at it in context. So if the government wanted to put its fist down on those intermediaries, then it could disrupt the Bitcoin system pretty strongly. And if it made strong overtures toward doing that, that would be quite disruptive because it would, for example, disrupt the price at the margin, and the price at the margin, as I just described, controls the amount of mining effort, and that would decrease the amount of mining effort as the price goes down, that would slowly, probably, decrease faith in the system. The way I think that the argument is wrong, though, is that there's a jurisdictional problem, right? A lot of this activity is happening in China, where the U.S. government doesn't have control of the technology, doesn't have control of the intermediaries, doesn't maybe even have as much leverage on the intermediaries. And so as a result, you would expect that if the government just came out today and said this system is outlawed, well, it's open source software. The technology is around. There are a lot of different cryptocurrencies available, so people would be able to. It would be hard to just ban it because, you know, you'd have to like search everyone's laptop and make sure they didn't have a copy of the software. They weren't running it. It would be quite challenging to do. There are more kind of offensive things you could do to try to disrupt the peer-to-peer networking. You could go after the links. So for technical reasons, the miners like to have dedicated links between each other. And so you could go after those, although I'm not sure on what authority you would go after those because the miners aren't breaking any laws, even if the transactions on the network are illegal. The miners aren't breaking any laws, and so it would be quite hard to go after them. As a result, there's an old quote about the internet that it routes around that it treats censorship as damage and routes around it. And the internet was designed originally with a design goal was to be able to continue to support communication in the event of a nuclear attack. And Bitcoin will, in a similar way, even though it operates at a higher level of abstraction, it will in a similar way route around this kind of activity just naturally at the technical level. For the reasons that the internet does, but also at the human level, because it's open source software and because it can be deployed and modified by anyone, and because the entities that keep it running are not necessarily the entities that are engaged in any illegal practices that would be enforceable.
That was such a great answer, both the yes part and the no part. And it validated what I thought, but you said it so much more eloquently. So thank you for that. Just as a pop culture note, the Big Bang Theory this week is about Bitcoin and the guys remembering that they had mined some Bitcoin 7 years ago and trying to find what they'd done with it.
So I was the terrible cousin, the family member that was giving away slips of paper Bitcoin to friends and family for Christmas back when I was mining in 2011 or 12. Mm-hmm. And I have gone through various phases of feeling just unbelievably embarrassed that I did that and had the gall to hand slips of paper as gifts. But one of my cousins this week texted me out of the blue, said that she had still held on to hers and she realized that it was now worth $500. So
very cool.
Makes me wish I had held on to all of this.
Yes. The Bitcoin discussion obviously could go on and on, but we have a few other topics that we'd like to hit this week. Mike Keyes, do you have anything else that you want to ask Joshua about Bitcoin economics before we move on?
No, nothing further from this end.
All right, Emery?
Nope, I'm good.
Nope. All right. Let us then move on and talk about a very important case that was in front of the Supreme Court this week, had its oral argument in the Carpenter case. This has been called by many people the most important digital privacy case to come before the court, maybe ever, maybe this term. It certainly builds on some other recent important digital privacy cases that the Supreme Court has had. This one involved smartphone robberies, the prosecution of smartphone robberies, and the procurement of location data about the defendant from his cellular provider. That data was obtained without a warrant. It was used to convict him, and he was sentenced to 116 and a quarter years in federal prison. So the key issue in this case is, particularly in the wake of some of the recent Supreme Court cases that we've seen on digital privacy, whether the fact that the data was being held by the third-party cellular provider meant that Carpenter had waived his privacy rights, Fourth Amendment rights, as to those bits of data, and law enforcement was just fine and dandy in obtaining it without a warrant. So that is what's at stake in the Supreme Court, argued this week. And Emery, yes.
I'm sorry, Denise, that was weird. I didn't mean to interrupt. But the other issue in the case that the ACLU raises is that so specifically Carpenter, his cell site location data was used to convict him, but it wasn't just the day of the robbery. It was, in fact, the government pulled 117 days worth of his cell site location data from his cell phone provider, a total of something like it was in the order of tens of thousands of individual location requests, so that it amounted to hundreds of location requests per day for nearly half a year. And so the ACLU was trying to raise the argument of whether the fact that this is historical data makes it a distinction. But yeah, the underlying issue is really all about the third party doctrine. And so I think that we've talked about it before, but it's the third party doctrine is the idea that you may have a reasonable expectation to certain information. But if you convey that information to a third party, sorry, cat, get off of me. Oh, they're staying here. If you convey that information to a third party, then the information, then you lose that reasonable expectation of privacy. And that is a doctrine that goes back to 1970, to a 1977 case, but that I think that most people, when you think about it in the context of today, can recognize that there's some sort of underlying problems with that, at least in the face of the reality of our connected world. It is, very difficult, maybe impossible, to not give your data to a third party. And in fact, the idea of whether we're, consensually giving that data to a third party is controversial in itself. And so, we're not going to have a decision in Carpenter until probably June. But there is some really interesting analysis just of the oral arguments and the justices' responses to the oral arguments that is sort of worth discussing. It is obviously a huge issue. At the end of the day, we are continuing to operate under the assumption that if you have any kind of third party in between you and your cell phone, that, the government can just go to that third party without a warrant, just with a much lower bar as far as whether that data is. I'm sorry, guys. Cat.
It's okay. Well, while you deal with the cat, I'll just mention a really great quote that I spotted about the case that goes to write what you're saying, Emery, which is that the third party doctrine hinges on an interpretation of the Stored Communications Act of 1986. And in writing this up for The Hill, Adam Levin has this amazing quote about the Stored Communications Act and translating 1986 digital policy into 2017 and beyond digital policy. Remember the 80s? Needless to say, it's an old law that was written when mobile phones were the size of a Scottish terrier and the only people who had them were drug lords, Japanese real estate moguls, and Ivan Boesky. So I think he makes the point that perhaps the justices should be thinking differently about these issues and about who has your data and what your expectations are about it than they might have been thinking in 1986. And that came through loud and clear in the oral argument, didn't it, Emery?
Yeah, so I actually haven't finished reading through the oral arguments. I've read a lot of analysis of the oral arguments, and I have begun to read through them. There's about 100 pages or so of that. I definitely recommend you checking it out. I will be finishing it this weekend. But I think when you first learn about the third-party doctrine as a law student, at least if you are maybe privacy-minded like myself, it sounds incredible, and it sounds totally incompatible with the modern world. But that is the state of the law that we've been operating under so far. So frankly, when I was reading about the Carpenter case beforehand, I was very much not optimistic at all. And it sounded pretty much like under, you know, the current understanding of the law that there's no real issue here, that he gave his data to a third party. And again, whether or not the data even was his to give. So what we're talking about here is cell site location data. You know, is this information generated on the phone or is it generated at the ISP about your phone? And that's really interesting in itself. As far as predictions on how this is going to go down, so far I've read that Sotomayor and Gorsuch, or Sotomayor at least certainly seems like she's on the privacy side. Gorsuch put forth a really interesting privacy argument. He suggested that he proposed the question that, so, okay, if someone has their location data at Verizon and a thief breaks in to Verizon and steals that location data, or T-Mobile it was in his example, does that customer have a cause of action against the thief? And, you know, is there some sort of conversion theory, which implies that he would be willing to extend a property interest in the data that the third parties hold, which is just really unprecedented, would be kind of revolutionary, and it would really change the landscape of how we consider our private data. And yeah, it's something to follow. It's really interesting. I went from being entirely pessimistic about this to very cautiously optimistic that we're going to get a good result in June.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like there's no breakdown on party lines on this issue. Maybe there are different approaches taken by part of the court. There's a really good piece in The Atlantic by Jeffrey Rosen analyzing the oral argument. And he writes that the conservative justices might hold with Gorsuch that Congress has created a property interest in our geolocational data, that the Fourth Amendment prevents it from invading without a warrant. The more liberal justices might hold that we have an expectation of privacy in electronic data that prohibits the government from tracking us over long periods of time, regardless of whether our property rights are invaded. Some justices might even embrace both theories. It is inspiring, he writes, in any event, to see justices as diverse as Gorsuch and Sotomayor providing constitutional leadership about the urgent need to translate the Fourth Amendment into an electronic age. So
it's really interesting because we've always, in the privacy world, we've said forever that, oh, privacy is not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. And yet it frequently is. But it does feel like that landscape is shifting, that, you know, more and more it's recognized that this is, you know, whether you want to come down this on a property interest or a individual liberty interest, this is a, you know, privacy crosses the political spectrum. So it's encouraging for all those folks that are maybe early career professionals getting into the privacy law space.
Right. And I think from the technological standpoint too, it points out that the court is really putting itself in the role of trying to understand on behalf of the public what's going on here. You know, you raise the issue, is this data on the phone? Is it at the cell site? Does that matter? My husband asked me when we were talking about the case, you mean there's no way to do anything to your cell phone so that you can't be tracked? You know, my understanding is that the answer to that is no. I mean, I suppose there are certain services and dark phones you can use that help enhance your privacy. But as long as you are within the cellular network connecting to a cellular tower, those towers are going to know where you are. They're going to register. You know, there were some 13,000, as you said, Emery, instances of where they were able to pinpoint this defendant's location over time. And that's simply a function of how the cellular network works. And many people, my husband included, just, you know, haven't put that together yet.
So, and I would think that many people, your husband included, would not consider himself as having consented to give that data over.
Right.
You know, it's not like he's saying, yeah, you can access it. It is, you're absolutely right. There's no real way to hide that information from your provider. Another interesting point that was brought up, I can't remember which justice brought it up, but they reiterated the point that was, I think, originally expressed in Riley, that, you know, smartphones are not really optional in today's world, that you have the, you know, it's not even like you have the opportunity or the option to choose between participating in the modern society and giving up your privacy or protecting your privacy and not participating in the modern society, which is interesting and encouraging.
Yep. Joshua, anything you want to add?
I had a question for Emery, which is based on the sort of the property interest you discussed that that Gorsuch was interested in. It strikes me that that would create a very different set of incentives in the in data breach law. And the industry has been very opposed to creating some sort of property interest in individual data, because it would mean that there's a lot more liability when a data breach happens for the company that's been breached. I'm curious whether when you looked at that analysis, whether that came up at all, the extent to which I'm not a lawyer, but I know a little bit about data breach law. I did work on a security team at a large infrastructure provider, and so I'm curious how that relates to this kind of property interest as a privacy question.
Yeah, I think it would really be a revolutionary turn to start considering that we have property interests in the data that third-party companies are collecting about us. Because I absolutely agree. I think that there's also a real problem with even the best of data breach notification laws that require companies to at least give out notice when there has been a data breach. It doesn't really provide any real recourse for consumers that have had their data lost and breached, and except for maybe piecemeal or temporary credit screening like we saw in Equifax. This is incredibly damage. It can be incredibly personal, incredibly revealing, personally identifiable information that can be used to steal someone's identity or, do a whole bunch of damage to their life. So on that front, I think it would be a way of putting some teeth to data breach notification or data breach laws. I think that Professor Oren Kerr pushed back against the idea of a property interest in that kind of data for those very reasons. I have to dig into his analysis. He also submitted an amicus brief in the case. It would be such a sea change that I wouldn't be surprised that if we do have a property interest in this kind of data, that you would think that data breach would be the next step, or data breach accountability would be the next step, rather.
I think you guys have given us our second MCLE passphrase for the show, which is going to be making off with the data. We do put these phrases in, as I explained before, for people seeking professional credit in their field. If you are a lawyer and want more information about that, you can head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and we'll give you some resources if you would like to submit on your own to be able to hopefully receive credit in your jurisdiction. We're not an approved provider, so we leave that to you. If you find this show educational and want to incorporate it into your CLE compliance diet, then hopefully you have the tools there you need to start that process. So let us move on. We have some final copyright stories to close out the show today. Mike, you wrote a fascinating article called Copyright Fair Use in the Land of Famous Potatoes on the TMCA. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, I was hoping you'd like it. I know you're such a big fan of the state of Idaho. So
yes.
Thank you for that. So it caught our attention for a couple of reasons. One, you don't think of Idaho as producing that many copyright decisions because there's not many copyright cases that are filed there. So that it kind of caught our attention from the outset. But then when we looked a little closer, presented some fairly interesting fair use issues associated with the court's decision. So the case is about an artist by the name of James Castle,
pretty renowned artist that lived in Idaho all his life. And one of the fascinating aspects of his story is he died back, I think, in the 1970s or so, I think. But one of the fascinating things about his life is that he could never communicate orally or in writing. Yet, despite his inability to communicate, he was a prolific artist. And his artistic works were created out of all sorts of different products, soot and saliva and just all sorts of stuff, discarded scraps. And so he gained quite a bit of renown for that over the years. He had a number of gallery presentations and other displays in art galleries throughout the world. So he was pretty well known in his own right. So there was this publication that led to the suit by his heirs. And this book was a fictional account of James Castle's life, told from the perspective of, I think it was his fictional cousin. And as part of the book, they incorporated about 28 different illustrations or paintings by James Castle. And so his heirs sued for copyright infringement, saying, you can't do that. The defendant defended based on fair use, saying, well, actually, we believe it's fair use because our use of these 28 illustrations is necessary because we need to be able to tell his story in this fictionalized account. We think it's very transformative. And ultimately, the trial court agreed and found that this was sufficiently transformative for purposes of fair use. The case raises some very interesting, intriguing fair use questions, not the least of which is if it holds up, if they don't appeal it, and if it's the Ninth Circuit were to affirm this decision, it would certainly open the door, at least in Idaho and maybe in the Ninth Circuit, for people to create fictional accounts of any artist's life, a name. Dali, Picasso, you could come up with a fictionalized account of that individual artist's life and incorporate his or her paintings into it, and it would be protected by fair use. So, that seems to me to be a fairly significant departure from what we typically think of as fair use, but we'll see what happens with the trial court or, like I said, at the appellate court.
Right, so what's your take on the fair use argument here? Because from my side, it sounded especially weak. I just want to hear your thoughts, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that if this is where fair use is going, I mean, the fair use exception is going to swallow the copyright infringement rule. Because, I mean, yes, I'm all about transformation, and I get it. I think that's the right legal test. But you've got to – there is an outer bounds to transformation, and I think this is kind of on the other side of out of bounds.
Printing the work in its entirety. I mean, they're not right. Modifying the actual painting itself. They're just saying, hey, here's the painting. It's transformative because it's next to a fake painting of his.
Right. I mean, so the court relied pretty heavily on a Second Circuit case dealing with an anthology that was created related to the Grateful Dead concerts. The defendant in that case had created like this coffee table anthology and used posters from Grateful Dead concerts in the anthology. Now, notably, they were small. They were kind of thumbnail size images. And he provided commentary with respect to individual posters and why they were particularly significant at the time of the Grateful Dead concerts in question. So in that case, I think that's a far, far stronger argument for fair use because you're actually using the illustration and you're commenting or providing some sort of historical context. Whereas here, this is just a fictionalized work, and you're somewhat capitalizing on the artist's work as a result. So
it feels like second, third, and fourth factor would fail against, or at least weigh against this. And I mean, I think the first factor too, if you don't buy the transformative argument.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right. Well, so we'll see please keep us posted. This case is early on, right? This was a TRO stage decision.
It was.
Yep.
was.
So we will continue watching this one. It's going to be fascinating to see how that comes out. Also fascinating is something that listener Jonathan Ennett wrote into us. I'm sure, or maybe I'm not so sure, that all of you have been seeing the fun that people have been having with the new iPhone X's and emojis. And one thing that people have been doing with them is mashing them up with music in various ways. So there is one guy in the UK in particular. His name is Duncan Burney. He has a couple of delightful ones. He is at Duncan Burney on Twitter if you want to follow him. Here's one.
God. Every passing second, I'm getting more worried about Disney and Cotton Warner.
It goes through the Imperial March and everything else. It's quite wonderful.
I do not envy the producer at Jimmy Fallon's show who had to clear all that music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't envy that either. But I think that Duncan Burney's, I don't know if he took the music straight from what was done by Jimmy Fallon and the Roots, or did other music and put it to the Animojis. I'm not quite sure actually.
He took the straight audio from
it. He did.
So when I was looking at trying to do a fair use analysis of the various Animoji karaoke videos that we linked here, I was most comfortable saying, all right, well, at least on that example, they're taking the actual video and the actual audio from the Jimmy Fallon show. It's the Jimmy Fallon, the Roots, and the Star Wars cast doing that song. So I have no idea whether they have any licensing agreement with the Big D or anything, but or the mouse. But in this video in particular, not only are they just using the audio to then put it over an Animoji character, so I assume that he was probably lip syncing or lip reading the song and then just composited those, but he also replaced he followed the design of the original video that Jimmy Fallon released, where the voices are in different placements around the screen and they sort of blink out at different times. And at certain times there are some people with like stormtrooper helmets. So for this example, I was most comfortable saying that this is a transformative use, but it's so music fair use is not a fun thing to.
No. And you can see there would be instances that Duncan Burney is using a hashtag and so are others. What is it exactly? Animoji karaoke. So you could envision that if you were actually covering a copyrighted song, you might have more legal cover.
Yeah.
No pun intended, under the cover doctrine. But even if you weren't, I'm wondering whether Jonathan wrote in saying, "Oh, we're going to see so many DMCA takedown notices over these things as they proliferate," and he's probably right. But if you're singing yourself, I think that might be one level removed and one more tick in the fair use column. And also just something about the Animoji technology itself, which is completely unique and not like anything really we've had before, which is it is the performer's facial expressions that are animating the character. So there is an aspect of performance that is not just in the software. So I think it's going to be an interesting area to watch on the legal front, particularly given that Apple has jumped right on the fact that people are Animojiing themselves and has done a commercial where the tagline is Animoji yourself. And that Apple commercial features a woman who is not covering a song. So it made me think about Apple's whole history and background with music, back to Rip McSpurn and then Don't Steal Music. And now they're on to Animoji yourself. And I'm not sure, how the music industry is going to deal with all of that, but
I would just be amazed if Apple didn't actually license that song for their commercial. But I mean,
that's true.
And even if they didn't though, I would say that the Apple music or the Apple commercial example would be more likely to be fair use than some of the other Animoji karaoke videos we linked, because there's the transformative element of like the purpose of the song has changed and the that show the actor on the screen. So like I could buy the transformative argument there. For some of the other ones, we have one where the person did like an AC/DC song with mm-hmm. three of the Animoji characters. And I don't see that standing up to,
right.
To, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But in the Apple instance, even if they did license the music for the commercial, and you're right, their lawyers probably made them do that. They are urging others to do this
yeah.
and probably, you know, rip, mix, burn, don't steal music
exactly.
and now Animoji yourself. So the messaging from Apple is interesting. All right. We have,
hey, Denise.
Yes.
So what happens if it's a robot doing karaoke?
BB-8. Oh, it's so cute.
That's clever.
Well, I think Emery had the answer to that one, Victor, that clearly the Sphero people were wise enough in partnering up with the Star Wars franchise to license the music used by the toys. So it's we who have to be concerned because we're now probably... you know, we're making use of the music from the Sphero, so let's make
commentary,
sure that we are doing
commentary.
News and commentary about it, analyzing yep. its potential fair use capacity, so that we ourselves would be under that doctrine, hopefully. Anyway, we have some concluding material, as we do at the end of the show. We have a few resources for you. Why don't you start us out, Emery, new law grad Emery, and new podcaster for the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. You guys have a new show?
We do. Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to plug it.
Sure.
The Internet Law and Policy Foundry, friend of the show, a source of innumerable number of guests on the show, and an organization that I am a fellow at. Is a collection of early career professionals in the tech law and policy space, in case you couldn't tell by the name. And we have a new podcast called Tech Policy Grind. You can find it on wherever your podcasts are found, on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or on our website, ilpfoundry.com. And yeah, it's a project I'm really excited about. We just launched the first three episodes this week. I am sort of... doing a crash course in all the stuff that the very amazing studio folks do at Twit to try to make the best production I can. But the podcast is really an interview show, but we also we like to bring Foundry fellows and friends of the Foundry on to talk about their journey, how they got from, you know, aspiring young bright-eyed students to super impressive young professionals in the fields they were trying to get into, to try to give advice to other young folks, other students, basically myself from 4 years ago, if I can send them back in time, to give advice on how to make it in the tech law space. And then we also, that's about half the show. And then the other half of the show is a deep dive, in the legal weeds of a particular area of the law or tech law that they are especially passionate about. So we've talked about CDA 230 with Tim Lorden and Ali Sternberg, AI and algorithms as they apply to justice, very much on Joshua's plate with Will Reinhart and Tiffany Lee. We just recorded a very, I think, an excellent friendly debate into the really deep policy issues surrounding net neutrality that we're going to be launching hopefully on Monday. And we have another interview with Camille Stewart on encryption and all the awesome work that she did in Obama's administration coming up in 2 weeks further. So we release twice a month. And again, the first three episodes are there on iTunes now, so it would be a huge service to me if you guys could go and listen to them. And if you like them, rate and review us on iTunes. It would be an enormous help. So
I can't wait.
That's my plug.
So excited that's there. Thanks for letting us know, Emery. And speaking of Camille Stewart, she has one of our other resources of the week this week. You may notice that despite the fact that it's December 1st as we are recording, we haven't had the chance, just we've had so much great discussion with Joshua Kroll today about other items. We did not get into net neutrality today, even though it is very much in the news and very timely. Hopefully we will do a deep dive on that next week. But in the meantime, one resource we want to point you toward is the way you can post a valid comment. If you've been paying attention to this at all, you know that the FCC has had just a nightmare experience with the comments around the net neutrality rulemaking process. Camille Stewart on her Facebook page has instructions for exactly, if you want to have your voice heard on the net neutrality issue, how you go about doing it. The link to follow, you can only do it from a computer now. You cannot do it from a phone. And the other thing I will caution you of is it does require you to include your email and return address, or not return address, just street address somewhere. So this is apparently part of how they are battling their bot issue. But, you know, just be aware that if you're going to go through this process, you do need to provide them with an actual verifiable address. So do go through that process. It is important. And then the other resource I'm going to throw in for you, since we didn't discuss net neutrality this week, is a piece by Del Cameron over at Gizmodo titled, "What Actually Happens the Day Net Neutrality is Repealed?" So what is going on here is we are heading toward December 14th, and a new rule is going to replace what is currently the Open Internet Order that has been in place since 2015. The new rule is going to be called Restoring Internet Freedom, the Restoring Internet Freedom Order. The final text of it is not available. Drafts have been out there. But basically, it is a sea change in what we have come to think of as net neutrality. The reason that I am recommending Del Cameron's piece at Gizmodo is it goes deep on the what happens next, to the procedure, how it's likely to be challenged, where it will wind up in court being challenged, because it will, and what that process is bound to look like. So the rule is going to change. ISPs are going to have more leeway to do things with their network traffic. It remains to be seen what they will do with that leeway, but the legal battle around it all is definitely going to continue, whether the FCC is going to continue regulating broadband services like a utility under Title II or not. Definitely, if you're interested in the what happens next and what it's going to look like, read Del Cameron's piece, and hopefully we'll talk about it more next week too.
The proposal so far is, by the way, a straight repeal of the three bright line rules established in the 2015 Open Internet Order against throttling, paid prioritization, and blocking. It's important. Please go check it out.
Definitely. Our tips of the week are sort of go hand in hand. One is from the Dorsey blog at thetmca.com. One of your colleagues there, Mike, had a great tip sort of post about substantiating ad claims based on consumer reviews. So the tip would be you can do some advertising based on consumer reviews if you're lucky enough to be a company or a service, an individual who's gotten good reviews. But there are guidelines from the National Advertising Division on how to do that. So if you are interested in doing that, you're going to want to check out Farah Sundergy's post. Am I saying that right?
Sundergy.
About how you go about complying with the National Advertising Division's rules. And then sort of the flip side of that has to do with the royal engagement that was announced this week and the fact that dating service Bumble took the opportunity of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle getting engaged to push a notification to people who had their app downloaded on their phones. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are engaged. Find someone who will treat you like royalty on Bumble. So that sort of advertising, I think you're going to want to steer clear of based on the fact that people's rights of publicity tend to get implicated in that kind of advertising, and not in a good way for you as the advertiser. I do think that that's a really interesting issue, though, that there is a corporate speech doctrine in which someone like Bumble could come in and say, no, really, we just wanted to comment on a current news item and congratulate the happy couple. We just threw in a plug for our company in the process.
Right.
we'll see how well that will fly, because companies, you know, more and more as they use social media to connect with their audiences, do these kinds of things. But it's fraught with peril, I guess, would be our tip there. And we have, I guess we sort of kind of had a little bit of animal selfie for you with the Animoji Karaoke's. Our animal selfie this week is in honor of the fact that we're recording this on December 1st and full bore into the holiday season. It's really an Elfie selfie. I'll let Victor show you for ourselves.
Oh, God. Those things are so creepy.
Elf on the Shelf.
I only learned about Elf on the Shelf this past, like, year. So weird.
So we talk a lot about animals stealing cameras and taking photos of themselves and the copyright ramifications of that. I think that we could safely say that the Copyright Office would not approve of the Elf on the Shelf having the copyright in his snaps here. However, it's highly entertaining, and who knows, maybe someday legal actions on behalf of the elf. Is there a society that protects elves and their rights? maybe they will come in and seek to enforce the elf's copyright. We will just have to stay tuned on that. And until next time, that's all we got for this week. We've had this really wonderful, long, deep dive kind of show with Joshua Kroll. Joshua, so great to have the opportunity to discuss these really important and interesting issues with you. We know your research is ongoing. Is there anything at Berkeley or involving the work that you're doing that you'd like to let our listeners and viewers know about before we sign off for today?
Yeah, and I should have had you add this to your resources page, actually. But if you go to fatconference.org, fatconference.org, there's a resources page there which contains links to just a bunch of great material on kind of fairness, accountability, and transparency. That's what FAT stands for in software systems broadly. And that conference, which is happening in February, so if you're in the New York area, definitely check that out when the registration opens. Will be an interdisciplinary conference on the sort of issues of fairness, accountability, and transparency in computer systems. It should be a great program. So that will be fun. And also in there are some resources on how to build kind of responsible, ethical computer systems. So I think it's a great set of resources. And I appreciate being on the podcast. So thank
that's
you,
so wonderful.
Denise and everyone.
Thank you so much, Josh. A couple of other things that we should plug just on our own behalf here before we say goodbye to all of you. We are assembling a year-end Twill show that will air on December 29th. If you go to twit.tv/bestof, you can submit your favorite clips from the year, and that will really help us out. We want to put together certainly our best of 2017 for you to air on that day. So we'd really love your help in putting that together.
And we're not good at going back and listening to old episodes of us. Like, I don't know about Denise or Mike, I'm really bad about actually listening to my own voice. So I haven't heard maybe any podcast episodes that I've been on.
Right. No, but I am good at remembering some of the great discussions we've had, today being no exception whatsoever. So I'm going to go through the list and put together some of my favorites. I hope you guys will too. Also, same. Just wanted to mention, if you are interested in law and commentary about law and ways of consuming that in a digital manner, the ABA has been putting together an aggregated list. That's the American Bar Association for quite some time now. and they have their ABA Web 100 out. And I just wanted to congratulate Mike Keyes. This may be a first, Mike. I don't know. If you're a person who's an author of one of the blogs on the list and a person who's a co-host of one of the podcasts on the list, and that would be us. So congratulations, yeah. Mike, for the twofer. That's fantastic.
Thank
the
you. TMC, no,
both the TMCA and Twill are featured.
Yeah, thrilled to be part of Twill and of course, thrilled to be part of the TMCA too. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for joining us, Mike Keyes, this week on This Week in Law. It's been a pleasure chatting with you as always. Hope things have been going well.
Always a pleasure. Yes, things have been going great. Hope all is well with all of you too.
Yes, very much so. All right. And Emery, we're so excited about you getting sworn in next week. The next time we see you, you will have you'll be a card carrying member, an actual card carrying member of the California Bar. Yay.
That's right. I was telling Franklin Graves in the chat that, you know, I think there's exactly one 24-hour period where you're permitted to call yourself Esquire before it's just totally insufferable. And so I'll probably have used that up by next time I'm on the show, but, you know, thanks.
All right. Well, we hope not. We'd love to be able to call you Esquire for a long time to come. And we're so glad that you've been able to join us today on This Week in Law. We've recorded this show on Friday, December 1st. We record the shows on just about all the Fridays that we can all make it here. We do so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, actually 1900 UTC this time of year, now that we've had our fallback time change. So we hope that you can join us live. That's always fun, but don't worry about it if you can't. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there for your listening and viewing pleasure, hopefully paying particular attention to the shows we've done in the last year so you can help us with the best of show. That would be really helpful. But whenever you'd like to listen, if you want to go back to 2013 or 2012 and see what we were saying about Bitcoin then, see how Evan Brown was certain it was going nowhere. we will certainly have all that there for you, hopefully for a long time to come. So delve into the archives. Definitely get in touch with us between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. So reach out to us in email. Our Twitter handles have been up throughout the show. Also, you can find the show on Facebook. That's a good place to write something longer than 280 characters if you need to. However you get in touch with us, we really love hearing from you. Also, to check out our show's Flipboard magazine. And if you'd like to contribute to that, get in touch with me by email. That's where we post up the links to everything that we plan to discuss on the show, things we're thinking about discussing. It's just a great way to connect with our community of folks who are involved in the show and let them know what we're thinking about and find out what they're thinking about too. It's how we put together the show each week. Also, if you ever are interested in looking at all of the resources that we've put together to prepare the show, you can find all those at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, and we break them down by individual episode. So with that, we'll go ahead and sign off. We hope that you have a wonderful week. Until we see you next time, take care.